Hey everyone, before we jump into today's podcast, I'd love it if you could do me two favors. First, if you're a regular listener, please do give us a thumbs up, or better still, leave us a quick review on the podcast player of choice that you're listening to us on. It does make a massive difference to us. If you could do me that small favor, I'd be so happy. Second, if you could do our sponsors a favor and check out their website, rocketsoftware.com. Rocket Software, of course, sponsoring us since the beginning of this podcast, to see why over 10 million IT professionals rely on Rocket Software every day to run their most critical business applications, processes, and data. Hey there. Well, I'm your host, Paul Muller, and welcome to another episode of Digital Disrupted. And today we're going to talk about a book whose author and the title of the book caught my eye recently as one of the LinkedIn posts they made. So we've invited them on. The author, or should I say co-author in question, is Paul Jeremais, who's a former colleague of mine. And he was the founder of the Hewlett-Packard Innovation Lab in Switzerland, where I first had the opportunity to meet him. And I was impressed by how he'd built really his own sense of agency, creating something that has become something of a legend, certainly within the company and eventually the industry. The title of the book also caught my eye, Enter Your Flow. Now, if you're tapped into the world of software development, you've probably heard that word a lot recently, talking a lot about flow states as we think about developing and delivering software better. And we think more about the work environment that knowledge workers find themselves in. And if you haven't, we'll strap in for what I think is going to be an interesting ride. Please welcome to the show, Paul Jeremais.
Great. Thanks, Paul. It's unusual to have two Pauls on the call, so I hope we don't get...
if you start interviewing me, we'll know that we've crossed that threshold. Hey, we're going to jump into it. It's good to see you. It's been such a tremendously long time since we've managed to catch up, which is great to be able to talk about the book. But before we do a little something called the lightning round to limber up our cerebral matter. You ready to play the game?
Well, if you're willing to take the risk, I will be. Yes, go ahead.
Well, your book's all about that, really, isn't it? So let's get going. First up, what would people say is your superpower, Paul?
Superpower? Well, if you ask other people, they will probably say relentless positivity. But I think if I think about it, I would say my superpower is abstraction. And I'll explain a little bit what I mean by that. The ability to abstract away from detail, make things simple for other people to understand. And with abstraction, you can actually look at the bigger picture and put things into context more easily. So I would say abstraction would be my superpower.
Love it. The most disruptive technology of all time.
Well, I would say that any technology which is sufficiently invisible that we still consider it to be magic would be a disruptive technology. And so for that, I would say wireless technology. And if you think about the early days of Heinrich Hertz, demonstrated electromagnetic waves, all what goes on today in terms of mobile phones, satellite communication, et cetera, is all based on wireless technology, which I think is... we should still be able to appreciate the magic that's behind that.
You know what? You got me thinking. The electromagnetic spectrum, full stop, is is incredibly disruptive, isn't it? We go all the way back to Faraday. Yeah. All right. The best quality, and you've seen a lot of these, the best quality a leader can have.
It's interesting. Often they say that you're only a leader if someone's following you. And I think to be a leader, you've got to be authentic. I would say authentic and have empathy. Today we talk about emotional intelligence, but certainly to be authentic, that's one of the most important qualities I would say is necessary today.
Without a doubt. So you've mentored, I know from, again, knowing you for many years, you've mentored a lot of people up through the ranks. What's your advice to people starting their careers?
I think... to do something. I think I would qualify that by saying a little bit more. Do something that you enjoy. I would say do something where you can add value, and also do something where you can learn and develop your own skill sets. And then after that, you'll pivot many times in your career. I started life as a musician, went on to computer science, been through various things through my life. But every stage, make sure you're enjoying what you're doing, making sure you're adding value. And obviously, people appreciate that value, and you're learning. And it opens up from there.
Well, we're going to talk in a second about framing, focus, and flowing. So speaking of framing, the first thought that comes to mind when you think of purpose?
First word, I would say passion. And I think from the passion, you focus on your aspirations, and that's your purpose changes over time. It's not just one fixed passion throughout your whole life or career, but I think it has to come from passion, what you're most passionate about.
Last question, if you could use technology to solve one world problem, what would it be and why?
That's an interesting one. I think I'd have to focus on an aspect of education. And if I wanted to use the words of the late Sir Ken Robinson, I would say it's about rewilding education in the same way that we're trying today to rewild nature. I think we need to rewild education. And what I mean by that is getting a better balance between left brain and right brain thinking, which, as we'll discuss in a moment, is part of the essence of what we're capturing in the book as well. So if we could use technology to rewild education, that would be fantastic.
It's interesting. I mean, I don't know if we've got time to talk about ChatGPT in the context of that, because I'd almost argue that, and this is my perspective on it, I'm a little biased, it could be an age thing, is that, you know, my nephew recently said, he's just finished his final years of high school, graduated with ridiculously high grades. We're talking in the top upper percentile of the whole country. Very bright young man, but he's looking at ChatGPT and he's talking to his teachers going, why are you making us write essays anymore when we've got software that can do it for us? So when you talk about rewilding education, I personally, that just sent off alarm bells to me, but I'd be curious. Maybe we can dig into that a little later on. Before we do that, it's probably worth just sharing a little bit about you and your background, because, as you pointed out, you've had an interesting career. It's moved around a little bit. I met you back when you were the leader, founder of the visionary behind the Innovation Center in Switzerland, which was servicing all of EMEA, but I think hosted people from all around the world. But your story starts before then.
Yes, so as I said briefly, I mean, I started my very early career as a musician, but then I went into engineering. I was a telecommunications engineer for many years, and then got into computer science, and from that became a lecturer, and then a consultant, and then eventually got it more into what I call the business of innovation, and that was more about helping other people to innovate. And that's why I set up the innovation centers in HP, to get organizations, individuals and organizations, to tap into their innate creativity, and oftentimes it's sadly ignored. And so that was my motivation. And then working on the book, what we're doing now with Worklife Flow, it's very similar. There's connectivity between all those areas, and it's all about making sure you're adding value and helping other people to engage in their own creativity.
And I have to say, watching you back in the day, you looked like you were the king of the happiest place on earth.
Many people are very jealous of what we do, but I mean, that's one of the motivations why myself and my co-authors got involved in this particular initiative, to enjoy what you're doing, because many people today are working and there's a negative connotation associated with the word work, and it's completely unnecessary. And providing you have the passion, you're enjoying what you're doing, and you're able to enter your flow, as we'll talk about in a moment, then you should always enjoy what you're doing. And it's such a shame not to. And I meet a lot of people in their early to mid-career, and they're just not enjoying what they're doing, and we're trying to change that.
So, yeah, let's talk a little bit about the title then, because maybe we'll talk about the title before the inspiration. I imagine one's going to lead to the other. Enter Your Flow. It does sound like it could be the title of a Bruce Lee movie. I don't know where that was coming from, like Enter the Dragon, Enter Your Flow.
Yeah,
some sort of Zen Kung Fu mashup. Tell us a bit about the title and how you came about, I guess, the inspiration to write it.
Sure. So there's a lot of talk today about flow and the notion of flow, getting into this state where you're relaxed but very concentrated. It goes in all domains. You know, the jazz pianist Kenny Werner talks about effortless mastery when you're able to get to this flow state. And I think everybody has experienced one time in their life this notion of flow. So what we've done with the work in our Enter the Flow is focus on the reader or the individual to help them tap in, to understand the conditions they need to get into that flow state and to appreciate it. And it can be applied to any aspect of your work and your private life, of course, as well. But a lot of people tend to ignore that, and other things take priority. And hence, sometimes people get stressed or they have negative attitudes towards work. So we wanted to find a way, a methodology of taking people through a process or methodology to enter their personal flow. And then it's not a destination, because once you've tapped into that, you can apply it to everything you do. And that's why you're able to find your fulfillment and happiness in what you're doing in a much more meaningful way.
And your co-authors, these are people I'd never heard of from your professional life. I kind of was expecting to see some names, I guess, that were related to your career who I knew. How did you come about meeting this? I'm going to use the word eclectic, and it's the only way I can think to describe this eclectic group of co-authors.
Well, initially, it was by chance. Three of us met in a bar in Geneva through a mutual friend, and we started talking. We all came from quite different perspectives. One of my colleagues is ex-lawyer, worked for United Nations. Another gentleman's got his own business working in Barcelona, and we realized very quickly during the conversation there was something special we'd all experienced in terms of working with people. Both people that were happy and successful, some people were unhappy and successful, some people were just unhappy and unsuccessful. And we felt as though we should tap into this and see if we could discover the essential ingredients to help people have a much more fulfilling approach to their career and their work life. Because, you know, we spend about 25% of our lives working and about 30% of our lives sleeping. So if we don't enjoy what we're doing when we're at work, it's a big shame. And so based upon that, during that conversation, we decided, well, let's get together. And we started formulating ideas about how we could actually have a bigger impact with these ideas. And we started working on that about 3 years ago now. And then I'd worked with our illustrator, Kevin Woodson, over many years for graphical illustrations. And so we thought this would be a great opportunity of finding a way to engage the reader in their personal journey. So, and then tapping into the left brain and right brain thinking. So the book is very much an interactive journey, capturing people's ideas as they go through. So our belief is that by the time you get to the end of the book is more valuable than when you started because you've added your own content to it. So you essentially become a co-author of your own work-life journey. And that's the basic idea. Those guys together, and as we worked increasingly, it became more obvious that we had some essential ingredients there that just needed to be shared.
Look, and I have to say, I haven't made it all the way through. I'm still, I only received it last week, and there's quite a bit, as you say, because it's not, for those of you who might have, you know, listened to the title and especially the subtitle itself, you might think it's a bit woo-woo, and it's definitely not that, but you might also think that it's one of those how-to books and it's very prescriptive. But one of the first things that struck me, A, was that you had illustrated it, and it reminded me very much of some of the Envision sessions you would do in the Innovation Center, where you would have, you know, when you'd have businesses in there and you'd draw some of the things they were talking about to bring them to life. So it immediately put me back in that mode. Mm-hmm. But the other was, is that, as you say, the book is incomplete. There are entire pages where I've got to write things down into the book in order for me to be able to progress meaningfully to the next stage. Now, it's not onerous. It's fairly light. But it's a continuous theme throughout the book. You're always sort of stopping after, I'd say, about 10 minutes, 15 minutes of reading and having to make some notes before you can then meaningfully move on to the next section. What was the impetus to take that approach? It's rather unusual for what I describe as a business book, essentially.
Well, I think this is one of the challenges that most people face today. It is actually just taking the time to stop and pause. A lot of people talk about mindfulness today, meditation, all sorts of things like that. But taking the time to stop and think, am I enjoying what I'm doing? Am I in the right frame of mind to be doing what I'm doing? Am I bringing myself 100% to my task at work, or have I got other things on my mind? You know, am I sort of gradually quiet quitting from my job because I'm not so engaged as I was before? So on and so forth. There's a whole bunch of, as I say, we go into a lot of detail in the book. And that was one of the reasons. We wanted to make sure the book was talking to the reader and the reader was taking the time to reflect on their own notion of what's going on in their lives. Because if you don't do that, you can't make changes. That's essentially the point.
Well said. So let's talk a bit about the three main sections of the book, because you've divided it. There are sub-chapters within each of them, but there are three distinct points within the book, the frame, focus, and flow. Maybe you want to walk us through each of them and why you chose that order.
Happy to, yeah. And this is quite important in terms of, as I said, we tried to come up with a very clean and clear, simple methodology or process to go through. So the first section of the book is called Frame. And the idea there is, and there's three main chapters there, first of all, to say, well, reflect on what does it mean when you go to work? Some people are now working remotely, some people still travel to work. But as you're going to work, are you taking 100% of yourself to work? Or are you partly leaving yourself somewhere else? And, you know, people always have things on their mind, etc. But it's good to take some time to think about your current context. When you're going to work, are you really taking yourself 100% there? And the second part is, when you're at work, what about your colleagues? What do you know about them? How much interest do you have in your colleagues? This comes back to the empathy and showing an interest. And the same goes for the organization you're working for. Do you have a good feeling about the overall purpose of the organization? Are you well aligned, or are you just there for the salary? And so that's the next part of the frame. And the third part is motivation. What really motivates you? And this is probably the most important part of the frame, your current context. Are you mainly motivated by extrinsic motivations? Your salary, your status, your title, or whatever? Or are you in touch with your intrinsic motivations? And we believe there's an imbalance today with a lot of people. They're just focused on extrinsic motivations, and sometimes they're not necessarily good ones. And so it's a question of getting the balance and digging a bit deeper to understand what are the true things that motivate you, and try to make that all explicit in your current context or your frame. And that's the first part of the book. Then we move on to actually digging deeper in terms of in the focus part, what are the things you really like, enjoy doing? And this can be quite challenging for some people, because you might be doing something which you're not 100% into. You're doing it for a variety of reasons. But digging deeper into that in terms of what your aspirations are, what are you trying to do? And this actually starts to get at the heart of your purpose, your passion and your purpose. You go through some very straightforward and very simple steps, but quite crucial steps to tap into those areas. Because we believe that every individual can grow in terms of their expertise and skills, etc. And it's a question of being aware of that to make sure you have the right conditions to grow.
I was going to ask you on that point, and I'm personally conflicted about this, which is why I want to toss it around with you, is I don't know if you've seen that short snippet of a video that Professor Scott Galloway gives, where he basically says, you know, the worst advice you can get given by people standing at the front of the room at a university, and they're usually billionaire, you know, guest lecturers, is follow your passion. It's because, right, you know, no one's passionate about chartered accounting. No one's passionate about, I don't know, oil, you know, iron smelting. But, you know, when you get good at it, you become passionate. Does that make any sense to you? Does that resonate, or do you have a different perspective?
I understand what you're saying. If people just use the word passion, then it gets a little bit too abstract, one could say. And I think basically what the starting point is kind of five steps to it. Firstly, you need to think about what changes do you want to see in your world, and it's not a question of saying the world. Focus on your world. What changes do you want to see in your world? And also, how can you contribute? This comes back to the value you're delivering. Why do you believe these changes are necessary, and who needs the changes? And then you think about who would value these contributions. So you can go through a very simple process to make it real. And then you start to understand what is it you really should be doing. Now, obviously, people are good at many things. Sometimes they decide not to master a particular skill or area because they're focused on a career or some other job. But I think it's just a question of having a clear understanding of what really giving you that pleasure, where your passion is. And that ultimately defines your aspirations. Coupled to that, though, is a very important step, and that's identifying what your limiting beliefs are. Because oftentimes people say, well, this is what I'd really love to do, but... They use this horrible word, but I can't do this. I've got a family. I've got a mortgage. I can't do this, etc. And so you need to identify the limiting beliefs and then find a way of getting rid of those, overcoming them, or at least be conscious of them to know that you can go down the path where you would get maximum pleasure and satisfaction and also feel as though you're contributing value. So there's a number of steps required to tap into that passion, purpose, or your aspirations. And then the second part of this focus in the book is looking at creativity and innovation. Because, okay, as the title of the book talks about flow, some people might play lip service to flow, but they've never really thought about it too deeply. And so we believe one way in which you can actually experience flow is by thinking about your own creativity and innovation. And this can be very simple things, based on things you enjoy doing in your childhood, like building sandcastles, jigsaw puzzles, or whatever. Or it can be more highbrow in terms of playing a musical instrument, painting, and doing various creative activities. But to tap in, but also to have a better attitude to your own observations. When you see something, you think, this could be done differently. What if we do something differently? But then doing something with your ideas. And then you suddenly get dragged or sucked into your flow state, and that's when the feeling of flow comes home. And what we believe is that you need to identify your own personal conditions for getting in this flow channel. That doesn't mean to say you're on a on a high all the time, but you need to actually understand the conditions that you require to get into flow. So when you have a particular job to do or task to do, make sure you're in the right frame of mind before you do it. Then you can experience the flow as you're doing it. And that is where, even if you're doing the jobs you mentioned earlier, which might not be the most exciting in the world, you can still enjoy them and get pleasure from what you're doing. And I personally believe that any job could be a pleasure if you have the right attitude and think about how you can improve it and perhaps innovate it at the same time. A lot of people in certainly large corporations today will spot things that they think could be improved. They don't say anything about it, so they don't feel secure in their job environment and they don't think it's their job. And we've got many examples in the book to illustrate this, to speak up. And that's all part of this creativity and innovation phase. And then we move on from the focus to the flow part of the book. And this is where, having experiences and got a much clearer understanding about what is it you want to do or should be doing with your life and your work, how do you find your voice? How do you actually articulate what it is you're doing and make sure that other people understand you and you understand other people? And how do you make decisions about your work life to go forward? Because the work-life journey is, there's no particular destination, but it's a question of enjoying it as you're going along. And that's why we go through these three phases: the frame, understanding your current context; the focus, understanding your main aspirations, creativity, innovation; and the flow, about understanding the conditions for going forward.
You know, I absolutely love it. The simplicity and as I say, the natural progression of ideas is fabulous. I'm curious, as you've been working on some of these ideas and knowing a little bit about your background, how much of this was document and now you're testing it in the real world? And how much of this had you built through the testing process and you've canonized it now into the written form? Tell us about a bit of the development process.
It's grown out of experience from testing these ideas, working with people. We've been interviewing many, many hundreds of people in terms of tapping into their current understanding of work, helping them also. One of my colleagues is very much involved in mentoring and coaching different people. We work with other organizations as well, the Conscious Business Institute, who are also very much involved in helping organizations creating a better environment for people to thrive and get pleasure from their work. And so we've done a lot of research, and so that's why we've taken 3 years gathering this information, validating our ideas and refining them as we've gone through. And as I say, the idea, why I mentioned about the abstraction, the idea was to have a very simple framework to help people grow through this journey. And now we're continuing with that process on trying it out on different groups as well as individuals going forward.
And I'm glad you raised that point. It was a great segue. I can see this being applied individually, and certainly it seems to make sense. Again, my recollection of you is just this incredibly powerful individual in getting a group of people, often from the same company, into a room and then aligning them around a sense of purpose, a sense of vision. You're an incredibly talented facilitator like that. My question was going to be, could this be applied in a group setting? If you've got for example, you're a manager or a leader and you're looking to try and raise the caliber of the whole team through being maybe a little bit more self-aware and for each of them to find their own flow state. Thoughts on that?
And that's why the early part of the frame is focused on your relationship to your colleagues. This is very important, and also understanding the role of teams, how they operate together. Because oftentimes in companies, and people go on leadership training courses or team building courses, and everyone wants to be a leader. Nobody wants to be a team player. So, and that's why the analogy we've used throughout the book is about going on a ship. We talk about flow, because when you're on a boat or a ship, everyone has a different role to play. Different people have different skill sets, and you have to learn to work together. And that's also very important, understanding and appreciating your colleagues and making sure that the right people are doing the right job and understand how it contributes to other people's success as well. And coming back to the leadership question you were asked at the beginning, it's very important as well for leaders to develop their people as well, to give them space to grow and develop, maybe within or without the organization. I've got many examples of my team members that grew within the organization and then they went on to do other things, and you have to encourage that. But oftentimes, unfortunately, people are focused on the extrinsic motivations and these sorts of topics get missed or overshadowed by other priorities.
Yeah, look, the other thing I'd say is, and what's been going through my mind as we've been talking about this is, you know, why aren't more people doing this with their teams? And I still suspect we've got this hangover from the industrial age, which, you know, again, let's give it you know, credit where credit's due. We had 300 years of ingrained management training that were refined as Deming, you know, documented most of what he was doing at the tail end of the industrial era. I mean, he canonized, he put into law the things that made successful industrial companies. There really hasn't been, I don't think, as much work done around what it means to be a modern knowledge worker. Right. Mm-hmm. So in the world of manufacturing, the industrial world, you know, it's very much a physical thing. You can see and sense success. You can measure it. You can put a, you know, a micrometer across it or a voltage meter or whatever it might be. You can weigh how many tons of iron ore you've refined.
Right.
But in the world of knowledge work, it is a lot less well-bounded. It is a lot more nebulous. And I suppose if I could maybe offer my reflection, this book is a bit of the beginning of a how-to for managing a team of knowledge workers, where flow state is an incredibly important yet almost impossible to define attribute of the success of a team.
You're quite right on the insights. And I think by taking a more group or organizational approach to this, what you're able to do is make sure the individuals are 100% engaged and they're giving their best. And there are many examples as well we've given in the book about teams that have gotten this right. And I think one of the reason we've written the book for the individual, though, is because there's a belief that if the individual is more confident in themselves, they're more resilient, then if there's change, and there will always be change in the organization, when change comes along, not to consider that to be a negative or a slap in the face. You're confident in yourself and you adapt with the change. Unfortunately, a lot of people wait until there's a trigger event which is imposed upon them before they do anything about changing their work-life flow. And what I mean by that, they are made redundant or they have a health issue or the company or whatever. And so the trigger is kind of a wake-up call. And our belief is that you can do this earlier and make sure that you're always in alignment with your personal values as you go forward. So the individuals are more resilient to change, because I've had a fantastic career from that point of view in the organizations I've worked for, but you have to, the organization doesn't owe you a living. You're there for a particular reason. And I think this is why there has to be this cohesion in an organization, in a team, to get the best value from the individual employees as you go forward.
Paul, absolutely fabulous stuff. Congratulations to you and your co-authors. What's the reaction been so far to the book?
Fantastic so far. So we're getting a lot of interest from organizations actually as well, individuals that have read the early draft of the book and want to spread this within their organization. So this is just a start from that point of view. We're just launching now other initiatives in terms of building up the community around work-life flow. And so I think it's going to have a good impact, hopefully.
I love it. If people are interested in bringing this into their organization or just learning more about what it is you do and the research that you do, where can people go to learn more or to engage you?
So we've got details in the show notes from this particular episode. So there's a Work-Life Flow website, and then people can get download information from that. The book, of course, is available on Amazon and sell sites like that. So I think this is a starting point, and we can encourage people. There'll be other material they can download in terms of templates they can use for their own homework, if you like, even with their colleagues, and work on some of the topics in the book.
I would normally wrap up here, but I did say at the start of the show we'd have a little sidebar chat about ChatGPT. Now, I know you're a technologist. You've been looking at technology all of your life, as well as a creative and a musician. So I guess actually this is the intersection of the two, isn't it? Because generative AI is now encroaching on, is mimicking, is karaokeing, if you like, what we would consider to be the domain of humans, which is the concept of creativity, of generating content. What are your thoughts about that? I'm just curious. Why did you think about getting ChatGPT to write the book for you?
Well, no, I didn't want to do that, but we have played around with it, of course. Interestingly, a lot of my early research when I was at Imperial College was about human-computer interaction, and that's where I started a lot of the work in that area. And I think today there's still this fear, unfounded fear, that somehow computers are taking over. Certainly ChatGPT, what it's doing is fantastic, but humans have to learn to interact and collaborate and cooperate with technology much more fluidly, if you like. And let's give you an example. There are many instruments today, like you can buy electric violin or some device, you know, something which you classically consider to be a violin, Bühler instrument. But when someone's playing an electric violin, there's many other things you can do with it, special sound effects, synthesizer, etc. So essentially you're learning to play a new instrument. And so if someone that's very good at playing an electric violin is not necessarily, same for a saxophone, is not necessarily a good violin player on their own right. So you have to learn the new instrument. And I think with ChatGPT, it's another technology. We just have to learn how to use it. It's not a threat. It's fantastic what it can do and what it can't do. You have to be aware of that as well. So I think there's always a, same with technology adoption or in general, you can either consider a technology to be disruptive in the negative sense as an enable or enabling technology. It can either be enabling or disabling. I think ChatGPT can be enabling, but we just have to learn to work with it and not be fearful of it.
Two last questions. First one, would you as a musician listen to an album written by a computer?
Well, I have listened to a lot of music, but personally, because I'm more of a piano player, my ear doesn't enjoy so much. It's very flat. The way it's quantized is not so enjoyable. So I'm still more of a pure and quite old-fashioned from that point of view. there's certainly a role, but I explore all of these things. That's the front. But you have to, same with modern jazz, bebop, et cetera, you have to dive into it more deeply to appreciate it and then retrain yourself to understand what's really going on.
Yeah, nobody understands bebop, let's be honest. And this comes from the father of a trained jazz musician. Right. All right. On that final question, the show's sponsor, Rocket Software, again, a big shout out to them. They've got a set of corporate values that they talk about, company values that matter to them, empathy, humanity, trust, and love. You don't need to pick one of those four. Just curious, what matters to you right now?
I think helping people to tap into their flow. Because as I say, personally, I find that once you've defined your flow channel, you don't want to come out of it. And that's the thing. And so, as I say, this relentless positivity that I talked about earlier on, it comes from there, basically. And I think you want to share, help other people. I know many people that are in jobs which are very stressful for a variety of reasons, but they have not yet had the trigger to stop or to change. And so we're just trying to find ways of helping people to wake up because, as they say, life's not a rehearsal. and if you're not careful, you spend too much time on the wrong things. It goes by very quickly.
Absolutely. Paul, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on. It's been far too long between gin and tonics. Great to see you. So thank you for joining us. And thank you again to Rocket Software for bringing us another episode of Digital Disrupted. And thank you for listening in. If you like what you've heard, do give us, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, a thumbs up on whatever podcatcher you happen to be listening to us with. You can also reach out to me on the Twitter. I'm still on the Twitter. Our handle's at XTheStreams, or our show sponsor for that matter, at Rocket. So if you've got any questions for our guests, such as Paul, or ideas for topics you'd like to hear covered in future episodes, drop us a line. We'd love to hear from you. With that, we'll see you all next week. Stay disruptive, everyone.